This is Cork City Community Radio News. It's 7 o'clock. I'm Raymond Brothers. Three Irishmen arrested over vandalism in a bar in Poznan have been released in time to watch the Republic of Ireland's Euro 2012 Group C opener versus Croatia. The trio were detained around the same time as 10 Polish men and one Croatian man were taken into custody. It is understood the Irishmen were with a large group from other countries when bottles, glasses and a lamp were smashed in a bar nearby. Consular officials were told no charges have been brought, as it appears the three men were caught in the crossfire of a row between ultra-supporters of rival Polish and Croatian clubs, but investigations are continuing. Spain has become the fourth country to ask for a bank rescue. EU leaders hoped the loan of up to 100 billion euro that Spain's finance minister denied was a bailout will stabilise a financial crisis that threatens to break apart the eurozone. The managing director of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, said the decision provides an assurance that the financing needs of Spain's banking system will be fully met. 14 people were killed in a helicopter crash in the Peruvian Andes. The 12 passengers were mostly South Korean, but included a Dutchman, a Czech, a Swede and a Peruvian. The two crew were also Peruvian. The men were exploring a potential hydroelectric project near Puno in southern Peru. It comes in a weekend of helicopter crashes, one in South Germany in which four perished and one in Kenya killing six, including the Kenyan Minister for Internal Security. A 21-year-old man is in a critical condition in hospital after he was assaulted by a gang of men in West Dublin. The man had been sitting in a parked car with friends at Fort Lawn Park in Blanchardstown at 6:30 a.m. yesterday morning when they were attacked by a group of men. He suffered serious head injuries and is being treated at Beaumont Hospital in Dublin. Three men in their 20s were arrested and have been held overnight at Blanchardstown Garda Station. Independent TD Mick Wallace may yet face prosecution for a self-confessed VAT evasion. The unorthodox TD's company, MJ Wallace Limited, will this week appear in the Revenue's published defaulters list. Experts have indicated that taxpayers who reach full settlements with the Revenue Commissioners do not normally see their names published and do not normally face prosecution.
The Cork FM weather with the Bollywood Lounge restaurant, Mount Oval, Registown. Relax in our stylish wine bar before or after your meal. Telephone 489 5333, open 4:30 Monday to Saturday and 12:30 Sunday.
Now for the weather, dry and bright this evening, apart from isolated showers that may drift in from the southwest. Current temperatures over Cork read 13 degrees Celsius. Next on Cork City Community Radio, it's The Art Show with Áine Deborá and Adam Wath.
Welcome to the arts programme, Cork City 100.5 FM. I'm Adam Wyeth, and each week I'll be talking to the great and the good of Cork literary life and beyond. My first guest this evening is Paul Casey, founder and organiser of the weekly poetry night O'Vale in Cork City, where he lives. Paul Casey's debut collection of poems, Home More or Less, was published last month by Ireland's leading literary publisher, Salmon Poetry, who celebrated 30 years in the business last year. Casey is currently on a reading tour around the country and beyond promoting his book. Born in Cork in 1968, Casey grew up between Ireland, Zambia and South Africa and has worked primarily in film, multimedia and teaching. His poems have been published in journals and anthologies in Ireland, the US, China and South Africa. In June 2010, he completed a poetry film based on the award-winning poem by Ian Duig, The Lama's Hireling, which premiered at the Zebra Poetry Film Festival in Berlin. So, Paul, you're very welcome to the show.
Thanks, Adam. It's good to be here.
Great. I wonder if we might begin by talking about your rather nomadic life, which in many ways is encapsulated within this book, Home More or Less. You're from Ireland, Cork, but grew up and spent much of your life in southern Africa. And you left a very different Ireland in the 70s and then went to a very different South Africa under apartheid regime. Can you tell me what this upheaval and switch of cultures was like for you?
Well, I... I had been travelling for quite a long time before we moved to South Africa. My parents first moved out to Zambia when I was 11 months of age, and I came back then when I was about 7 and came to school till I was 11. So I was used, and I had a good idea of the African climate and the difference between the Irish and African cultures in a very general sense. But in Zambia, we'd lived in really very much of an expat bubble, if
right.
you like, where it was full of hoolies and kailies and hurling matches, and
right.
We were very much living in another county, if you like, of Ireland.
Wow. Okay.
But when we went to South Africa, that was very different. We were submerged into the greater urban sprawl of Johannesburg, and apartheid was at its zenith
right.
at that time. And culture shock would be.
Yeah.
Probably.
So what was that? I mean, how old were you then when you were in South Africa? And what was that like? I mean, how did that affect you as a family? Because I'd imagine not being Afrikaans and being Irish, there would be quite a different quite a shocking reaction to apartheid. Or was it something, because you were young, perhaps you weren't so much weren't aware of it. Was apartheid hidden from white people, or was it something you were very conscious of?
No. There was always a great liberal community within Johannesburg. And within the great cities, there was always most of the conservatism of the time was rural, not to say that there wasn't urban conservatism.
Mm.
But so we were always privy to the conversations that would surround apartheid and in what was wrong with the government, essentially, at the time. There was a great anti-feeling towards the apartheid government among white South Africans.
Right.
So there was a cushion, if you like. There were safety zones, you know, that you would live in. You weren't forced one way or the other to live in any particular culture, because there was the Afrikaans white people on the one side, there were the English-speaking white population on the other, and they were about equivalent in terms of population mass. And then,
right.
of course, it had been divided into then your colored community, and then one layer down, your Asian community, one layer down again, your native black African community. I mean,
yeah.
And we felt quite at ease slicing through those layers, although you'd have to keep a vigilant eye out. You know, it was very militant. You know.
Right. And so day-to-day life, how did this affect when going to school, getting public transport, those sort of things? What was that like? Was it tense, or were you very much protected and sheltered, or was it? I mean, now it's a very dangerous place, Johannesburg. Was it as dangerous back then, or
no? Physically, we were a lot safer back then, certainly. The threat really was an ideological threat. There was the constant pressure to conform politically, ideologically, you know, upon the youth of South Africa. And everyone was conscripted into the army. At the time you were 17, you had to spend 2 years in the South African army, or you go
right.
into prison for 4 years.
Wow. Which is what happens here. You were conscripted.
I was conscripted. They wanted me to go and shoot guns at people, and I said I wasn't going to do that. But if they let me be a medical orderly, that I would go, so I could at least learn something and
right.
be among. I was trained as a soldier, but I worked as a paramedic essentially for 2 years.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that must have been very hard. And so, when did poetry happen? When did that start in your life? Were you writing from a young age, or when did you first start getting interested in that?
I was writing from my teens, mainly in the form of comic books, self-made comic books. And then I moved into film, and I started writing film scripts with other people and by myself. And it was only after I left South Africa, I was 21 years of age, when I finally left South Africa and started traveling the world and trying to find my own sense of identity, which had been splintered, if you like, at that point. And only then did I start writing poetry.
Right.
Yeah, my early 20s.
Okay. Mm. And, well, this book is very much the fruit of that. Those are the first seed, more or less. And I mean, a thrill to have it out, perhaps, and a relief to have your first book published, I imagine. How does it feel? Because it was only last month that we had a great launch in the Triskell Art Centre Church with Afric McGlinchey, who's publishing her first collection as well. Another Irish person who spent much of her life out of Ireland in Africa. But how was that for you, you know, having, what's it like having
your first book out? It's a great feeling. It's a well-earned tabula rasa, if you like, creative tabula rasa. You know, I feel like I can go back to a clean drawing board now, because you carry poems around with you for a very long time until they find their place.
Sure.
But it feels fantastic. I think the world, poetic world, has certainly opened up a lot more to me. Myself and Africa, as you know, are on a big tour at the moment around the country. So we've got 4 readings down and another half a dozen to go.
Okay, we'll talk more about the tour and the readings coming up. You've got 4 tracks. Can you tell us, we'll hear the first track that you selected. Can you tell us the name of it and a little bit about it?
The first track is by a Zambian band called Los Camarados. It's a very traditional Zambian ethnic band, and their song is called Chomba Malaila.
Brilliant.
Chomba Malaila Wila ichebela pakwenda mayo.
Radio on 100.5, Cork City Community Radio.
Welcome back to Cork City 100.5 FM. This is the arts programme where every Sunday we welcome a guest from the arts. And my guest this evening is Cork poet Paul Casey. You can get in touch with us by text on 086 736 4667. That's 086 736 4667. Or if you prefer, drop us a line on our Facebook page, The Arts Show on Cork FM Community Radio. Paul, you're very welcome back. And I think you're going to read a poem that follows that song somehow from your collection, Home, more or less. Will you tell us what the poem is called and something about the poem?
Sure. The poem is called Bare Feet on Hot Tar, which is set in Zambia. I haven't seen Zambia since I was 11 years of age. Funnily enough, I've met a lot of Zambians since then, but this is at the early part of the collection, as it is fairly chronological.
Right.
So, Bare Feet on Hot Tar.
Great.
A woman sits under the makuyu tree. There is a pile of newspaper pages, a tonga basket of monkey nuts. She has the largest breasts in the world. Mangoes, pawpaws, even watermelons cannot compare to these. For 5 ngwe, she will roll us up a paper cone full to the brim. Zikomo amai, we say. We jump between shadows of malachite, leaves, copper sun, amethyst sky. Red dust and shells fall behind. Africa, everyone's mother, is tough as summer souls, hot and dark as sleep.
Wonderful. This is a brilliant poem. It really captures the richness and the aliveness of Africa. I mean, we were talking during the break there about, you know, I've been to South Africa, Southern Africa a few times, and I mean, one of the things, well, it's just so huge. It's a huge continent, but South Africa itself is a huge country, and everything seems much bigger, brighter, the people, you know. I mean, how does that compare? How does living in Ireland, living in a very small country, an island, compare to living in, you know, such an extraordinary place, like South Africa?
Well, funnily enough, I found more in common between Ireland and Africa than differences, especially within relationships. The importance placed on family is very high there. The place of the mother is very strong. There's a great oral tradition among African poets. You know, they only started writing down their languages between 100 and 200 years ago.
Yeah.
And so everyone in Africa, whether they are your aunt or your mother's friends who are women of your mother's age, are referred to as mother. You always call a woman who could be old enough to be your mother,
right,
regardless.
Yeah.
You know.
Yes, a great respect is a big thing for your elders there, isn't it? And yes, that's definitely something that came across. Yes, no, you're right, there are similarities, and that's something you, within the book, that you mix very well, the mixture of this, of African themes, and then the Celtic, bardic tradition of storytelling, myth and folklore, that also, you know, plays a large part of your life. Mm. But coming back to Ireland, when you did return in 2005, it wasn't quite the fairy tale you'd hoped for in many ways.
Well, I wasn't hoping for a fairy tale.
Right.
Definitely not. I've been coming back to Ireland since the 80s, you know, periodically since the 80s.
Okay.
I've lived here throughout the 90s in different parts of Ireland, in Galway, and in Dublin, in Wicklow, and in Cork, indeed. So I knew what I was coming back towards. I've always been in touch with the news, too, having sort of kept up the connection since I was very young. You know, news of home was always news of what was happening here, no matter where you were in the world, you know?
Yeah.
Like working in Tokyo, I'd go into an Irish bar and they'd say, when last were you home, you know?
Right.
And it doesn't mean, you know, when last were you where you're living now, when last were you in Ireland.
Yeah.
You know? So,
But no, what I mean is, in 2005, you made a decision, well, to come back. Was it to come back definitely, or was that not on the agenda? But you came back anyway, and well, something happened. You needed help from the state, and you were treated, well, not as an Irish citizen.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it was in 1999 when I had last left Ireland that I decided I'm going to give myself 7 years maximum. to get the itch out of my feet, so to speak, right?
Right.
That if I don't manage to settle by the time I'm 35, then I'm going to be in trouble. So I plan to come back for the Capital of Culture year 2005, and to come straight down to Cork. And when I got to Dublin, what I didn't realize was that the market would be flooded with sort of cheap labor, if you like, from Eastern Europe. So there weren't jobs available.
Right.
You know, as people may have been jumping around saying, you know, how rich their country was, and the newspapers were saying it was one of the richest success stories in the world.
Mm.
It was quite obvious to me that that just wasn't true, you know. That Dublin was full of homeless people.
Mm.
And I myself became homeless as a result of it. It took me, because of the habitual residency condition which they'd brought into place since my departure, which basically says if you're out of the country for longer than 2 years and then you come back, you're not entitled to any assistance whatsoever until you've been back for a period of 2 years.
Wow.
Right? Working for 2 years. And of course, I was looking for work, you know, day in and day out. I've worked all my life in different jobs and what have you, but I mean, I love work. It's not something that, you know, I'm just not a lazy person, essentially.
Mm.
But that wasn't enough to convince the powers that be that I deserved some kind of assistance or help. So I decided to fight that from the streets of Dublin, and it took 8 months for them to say, okay, fine.
Wow. So those months you were living on the streets. I mean, that was
the first 4 months. I was given assistance by the asylum seekers unit,
right?
And they would pay for me to live in homeless hostels during that time. And I stayed with some friends, but I didn't want to really lean on my friends and all my family down in Cork. I didn't want to lean on any of them, you know. So I kind of kept to myself and just sort of tapped away legally at the government. And when they eventually cut me off from the hostels, for the second period of that 8 months, I was living under bridges and in doorways and...
That must have been very hard and very strange as an Irish person for that to happen. You know, it seems at an extraordinary time as well, when the country was supposedly doing so well and was, you know, so rich and things.
I mean, for me personally, it wasn't that strange. For a lot of people I know who got hit with that, they felt very put out by it. And for me, on the one side, it was a big adventure for me because I just love. The solitude of wandering and discovering things on your own terms.
You know, right.
It's kind of the poet in me, I suppose. I could see that Ireland had bought in and it had aligned itself to sort of Western politics more and more and more over the years. Finally, adopting a lot of American values, for example, politically speaking, and losing its sense of community. Losing its real sense of responsibility for the average citizen. So, I mean, I personally wasn't particularly shocked. I just felt compelled that I should stand up and say something about it rather than, you know, take a slap on the wrist and run away.
So you did, and there's been quite a lot of media attention. I mean, you were on RTE last year.
That's right,
talking about it and things. So there's been quite a bit of media attention towards that. And I mean, in your mind, I mean, there doesn't seem to be, but is there any ambivalence of place, of where you belong? You know, do you feel, do you feel more connected to Ireland or Africa?
I've always felt more connected to Ireland.
Right.
I tell you what, I not only had all my holidays here when I was younger and spoke Irish when I was young.
Mm.
Forget the fact that I was born here, as were my parents, as were. They're all their parents. All my four parents are in St. Finbar Cemetery. You know?
Wow.
My four grandparents. Yeah, I can go visit them all in one go. And I knew and loved them all very, very closely and very well. I think the first 11 years of your life are really, you know, the most formative. I mean, culturally, all my references were to Ireland. Even in Zambia, living in an Irish expat bubble, it was all about, you know, the news of what was going on here.
Mm.
And our holidays were always spent back here. And this was always home.
Mm.
South Africa, I gained a great love for. I met some fantastic people and I learned a lot, languages and so forth. But I could never... There was always a great cultural gap. There was a point at which people would just not get me.
Right.
You know.
Okay, wonderful. I wonder, can we go to your next musical choice? Can you tell us the title of it and maybe a little bit about it, why you chose it?
Sure. The next song is called Aganagi Nogonaga, which means he doesn't care in Zulu. It's a song by Juluka.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and it has to do with the forced settlements that were happening during apartheid in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. 70s and 80s, mainly, yeah.
Okay, very good.
Donal Lenehan, rugby hero and all-round sportsman.
My father was a Kerry man, came to Cork as a 17 or 18 year old, so as you can appreciate, GAA was huge in his household growing up, and indeed he played with St. Nick's in Cork and won a county football medal with two Gaelic football and hurling. Yeah, I played in national school with St. Patrick's and played with Brian Dillon's and St. Nick's Glen Rovers. Well, I went to secondary school in CBC, was introduced to rugby by the famous brother Philip O'Reilly, and I suppose never looked back. I played both codes up to about 17 or 18. 1985 was a special year. McDowell brought on a young, enthusiastic side, played a different brand of rugby, so we were left the last game of the season against England playing for the Triple Crown. Brian Spillane won a magnificent line-out about on the English 22, which I took on deep into to English territory. It was tackled by Rob Andrew, thankfully retained possession. Michael Bradley had a magnificent pass to Michael Kiernan, who, with three fellas outside him, a try looked on, but he took the brave decision to go for the drop goal, executed it brilliantly. I was lying on my back under the goalpost just from the previous ruck, and just saw the ball going over the bar and the hole of the terraces and Lansdowne Road erupt, and it was a fantastic feeling.
Where your radio comes alive, 100.5, Cork City Community Radio.
And on behalf of Cork City Community Radio, I'd like to remind our listeners of a great fundraiser we have coming up on the 14th of July next with the Santa Ponza or Bust with Paddy O'Callaghan and Frank Toomey. For any of you, those of you who remember, it was the Dragon's Den sensation. So it's on the 14th of July in the Blackrock GA Club, locally known as the Rockies, and the tickets cost €15 each. Or 4 for €50, or parties of 10 for €100. And they can be got here from the studio, or I can give you a mobile number, which is 087-681-7657. But any of the volunteers involved with the studio here have them. So the Santa Ponza are a bust on the 14th of July in Blackrock GA Club, otherwise known as the Rockies. And we look forward to seeing you all there.
And you're very welcome back to the arts programme, Cork City FM. Where my guest this evening is Cork poet Paul Casey. You can get in touch with us by text on 086-736-4667 or drop us a line on our Facebook page, The Arts Show on Cork FM Community Radio. You're very welcome back, Paul. Now, as well as being a speaker of Irish, you're also somewhat fluent in African languages, I believe. In the book, you have a poem written in Zulu. How did you come to learn Zulu? Because presumably this wasn't the kind of thing you were taught on curriculum when you were at school.
No, it wasn't. I picked up Zulu much later. When I went back to South Africa after travelling for a number of years in different countries and working, and went to university there for a few years, and I chose it as a subject, and I kind of intensely dived into it for a year. But I had been surrounded by it for, you know, 10 or 11 years before, so I knew the rhythms of the language, and I certainly had, you know, a lot of small sayings, as most South Africans would would have. Plus, it seems to be the English, the easiest rather, South or African language to learn of all the African languages. Okay. It's the most simple to access, and it's the most popular in South Africa. So it was an obvious choice, really.
Mm. And it's, I mean, a lovely sound to it. It's so musical, isn't it? It's sort of, you know, very, you can hear the drums going on in it. I mean, does Zulu have the click sounds as well? Because there's the Xhosa, do you say, language, which is in Xhosa.
Yeah, Xhosa and Zulu are actually the same language, really.
Okay.
There's only perhaps 150 to 200 years of a split between them.
Right.
So they'd be closer than Northern Irish Gaelic and Scots Gaelic would be.
Okay.
So if you speak Xhosa, you'll understand Zulu and vice versa. But okay. There's only a few different kind of clicks in those languages.
Right.
There's actually a language which is made entirely of clicks.
Right.
And that's the Bushman language, Ikhlung, it's called.
Okay.
But very, very few people can speak that.
Yeah. Okay. Would that be spoken in Namibia?
Namibia, yeah.
Right.
Kalahari Desert around that, you know.
Right. And I believe you're going to treat us with a reading of the Zulu poem and then read the English translation.
Sure.
Brilliant.
I'll do that. It's called Anginyamalalanga, which means, and it's one word, it means I haven't disappeared. How Africa uwafihiligupi amapupo ami. Gogo wamatemba ami. Angilalanga nawe izolo. Auzange ubuno. Imibuzo emehlweni ami.
Giamanga alangani, ukoshiwengam. Anginya malalanga. Home for wetu. Asibonanga uguganye, gwenyanga, ugufunayo ganye. E Zambia, ne zindlovo zingani. Mfo. Bisinge munye Swaziland. Sibonga nkanyezi egukaleni gwako. Sisi. Nkumbuti wako. Uchwala bentando yako. Abuzange butabule zinyo ozami. Itribini lintlabati panzi. Emalawi. Baba. Ndlela yami. Asinukanga uchani. Bokufulela imuva gwemvula. Panzi e Botswana. Kushisa shi. Anginya malalanga. How? Afrika. Mklaumbe. Ugugug. Agumemezi. Elesutu. Lapo izinkulunkulu zezintaba ziqhedwa kukhala. Ukulume ulimi lomlilo. Elidala ibeobeb. Noma e-azanya ipi leyondoda yomlungu. Leyonhlanya emhlophe. Ngege igubone. Isaqabanga ngekhanda layo. How i-Afrika uthando lwakho. Lunyamalala njengamafu. Anginyamalalanga. Angisanyamalalanga. And the translation is, I haven't disappeared. Africa, where did you hide away my dreams? Grandmother of my hopes, why do you not greet me? Did you ever see the questions in these eyes? I wonder why you forgot me. I haven't disappeared. Brother, didn't we see the same moonlight once in Zambia with the small elephants? Bro, weren't we together in Swaziland, where we praised the star of your beginning? Sister, your brew, the beer of your love, did it not kiss my feet with the sands of Lake Malawi? Father, my path, did we not smell the thatch after the rain, under the fresh heat of Botswana? I haven't disappeared. Africa, maybe old age doesn't announce itself in Lesotho, where the mountain gods end their tears, where you spoke the old fire language of the baobab, or in Azania, where that white man, that lunatic who will not see you, still thinks with his head. Africa, your love disappears like the clouds. I didn't disappear. I still haven't disappeared.
Wonderful. That's Paul Casey reading from his new collection, Home More or Less, which is out with Salmon Poetry. Available from all good bookshops, if there are any left, and available online as well. I'd imagine it is with Amazon and all those sorts of places as well. I wonder, Paul, we might talk about the writing process. I mean, especially for a poet, because I imagine it's very different how a poet might work and how, say, a novelist or a journalist, obviously, who has to, you know, work by the clock. I mean, how does a poet work? Do you have a system set out? Do you write for every day, for instance? Is there a particular time? How does that work for you?
Well, for me, it is quite a random affair. I think what's most important about being able to write poetry is that you have prepared yourself as a vessel for the poetry, because poems can hit you in the middle of the day. They can come in the middle of the night and wake you up and get you up out of bed, scrambling for pen and paper.
Yeah.
I usually get up between 6 and 8, and I try and spend a couple of hours in the morning writing, but I don't force, you know, anything in the doing of that. I just write whatever's going on, really.
And do you begin in longhand, or do you go straight onto a word processor computer?
In longhand.
Right.
Yeah, I always use pen on paper first. I need that physical connection. It's a very,
yes,
it's a very electrical connection between the pen and the paper, I find, you know.
Right.
And then later, much later, when it's ready for editing, I'll take it into the computer.
And how long does it take for a poem to come from the beginning, from the initial line, words, ideas, to the final part when you're happy to send it away to a publisher? How long does that take for you?
Well, there's no one answer to that question.
Right.
I mean, my first, if you like, major poem arrived and was finished within half an hour, and it's a 10-page poem. It's a 10-minute poem.
Wow.
That's recited, a really long poem.
Mm.
And aside from a couple of small nips and tucks, it hasn't changed at all from the original. But other poems, you know, much, much shorter poems, can come to me very vaguely as a very vague feeling or idea or indeed an image or a vision.
Mm.
And it takes me a long time to work it until it finally reveals its shape. You know, it can take months. I've got a lot of poems sitting on the back burner for years now that hopefully will someday get finished.
And how did you, I mean, of course, you know, practice is everything and dedication, but how do you learn to become a poet? I mean, what advice could you give to people who perhaps are interested in writing poetry but want to develop it further?
Usually now when I'm asked that, I pass on the words of Desmond O'Grady, who you know so very well, and that is to know your craft. Know your craft. Keep learning your craft. You know, pick up a Norton anthology and learn the difference between, you know, an iamb and a troche, between a feminine and a masculine ending in a line, and between a sonnet and a villanelle, between form and free verse, you know. Mm. And just practice, trying to create work which includes all of those elements, you know.
Great. Mm. And talking about Desmond O'Grady, a man who's very much a vocational poet, and poetry is very much seen, you know, as a vocation. Was there a point in your life, I mean, we talked about when you first started becoming interested in poetry with comic books and such, but was there a point in your life when you thought, you know, a poet, yes, that's it, that's what I want to be? I mean, and do you see yourself, I mean, now, obviously, you've got a book out, and you know, of course, you know, you're hailed as a great poet and things. But do you feel in yourself, you know, was there a point in yourself when you thought, yes, now I'm a poet? Was there a change at all, or did it just develop?
There was. There was a very definite point. I mean, people say to me, you don't know you're a poet until a great poet tells you you're a poet, right?
Yes. Yeah, so didn't W.H. Auden said something? It's not for you to call yourself a poet. It's for somebody else to sort of give you that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that has happened to me, thank God. But,
right.
But only since I already knew I was a poet. It was about 10 years ago.
Right.
When I wrote the poem I just told you about, the 10-minute long poem.
Right.
It's Not All Bad, which is published in its own chapbook form, which is a small little thin volume.
Okay.
The moment I finished that poem, I put my pen down and I was in shock. I knew that this is what I was all about. It was just so rich, and it engaged with every ounce of my creative being that I just knew that there's nothing else that I should be doing. And I became quite depressed. I thought, oh, my God, I'm a poet. I'm going to have to live in this life of, you know, I was excited about the poem, but about being a poet, I wasn't very excited at all. You know, but
right.
I knew I was a poet. And indeed, from then, I did nothing but write and be involved in the world of poetry.
That's extraordinary. Yeah, it is extraordinary how it grips you. I think we're going to go to your next musical choice, which is...
Next musical choice is Linton Kwesi Johnson.
Wonderful.
Reality Poem.
This is the age of reality. From how we deal with mythology, this is the age of science and technology. But from how we check the antiquity, when we can't face reality, we let go with clarity. And some latch on to vanity, and some whole insanity, and some get vision, and start preach religion. But them can't make decision when it come to a fight. Them can't make decision when it come to a rights. Man, this is the age of reality. But somehow we a deal with mythology. This is the age of science and technology. But somehow we a check for antiquity. Them when they gone out of line, them not living for a time. For them say them get signed and them blind. Them eye to the light of the world. I'm gonna search within. The dark of them doom and a show about sin instead of fight to win. Man, this is the age of reality. But somehow we a deal with mythology. This is the age of science and technology. But somehow we a check for antiquity. This is the age of decision. So make we Lego religion. This is the age of decision.
so make we Lego division. This is the age of reality. So make we Lego mythology. This is the age of science and technology. So make we hold the clarity. Make we hold the clarity. Make we hold the clarity.
Weekend Radio on 100.5, Cork City Community Radio.
And you're very welcome back again to the arts programme on Cork City 100.5 FM. My guest this evening is Cork poet Paul Casey, and you can get in touch with us by text on 086 736 4667 or drop us a line on our Facebook page, The Arts Show on Cork FM Community Radio. Now, Paul, as well as being a poet and a filmmaker as well, which we hopefully we'll have time to talk about, you're also a director and host of O'Vale, which is happens every Monday at the Hayloft pub. Can you tell me more about the night, and for people who perhaps haven't been, what they might expect from the evening?
Sure. Well, it's a night full of poetry, really, full of original poetry. There are three parts to it, centred by a guest poet from either around Ireland somewhere or from overseas, and we have 50 nights a year. So obviously, as you can imagine, it involves a lot of running after funding applications and
yes,
what have you to fund it. But before the guest poet, we start with a short poetry challenge where the audience throw out five words and get given 15 minutes to write a poem including all those five words. And there's a prize for sort of the loudest response. So that really sort of breaks the ice for the night. It warms up the sort of atmosphere, which is great. And then the guest poet sort of takes it from there for perhaps half an hour or so.
And I should point out, I mean, you've had some wonderful guest poets over the years. I mean, Derek Mahon, Nuala Nagonal, Paul Durkin, and last year you had the British Poet Laureate Carol Ann Duffy. So it's, I mean, an amazing to get, you know, this level of guests, you know, as you say, I mean, and to do this on a weekly basis is a huge undertaking.
Yeah, sure, I suppose it is, but, you know, it's something that it's more streamlined now, so it's a lot more easy. But we look to cover the whole spectrum of kinds of poetry and also...
Yes, I should say, so as well as the more established poets, you also have performance poets and also alternative poets, all sorts.
All sorts of poets who just had their first collection out, perhaps. Or they don't necessarily need a collection, you know, just as long as they have enough of a repertoire, of a good enough repertoire,
yeah,
really, I suppose, you know, for a half an hour. And then we end the night with an open mic, so local poets every week can get up and read their own.
So anyone can bring a poem along and come along and read it?
Yeah, or really sing a song if you really want to.
But okay.
It's mainly poetry.
Very good. And as well as being, as I said, you know, you're also a filmmaker as well, and you've been exploring this new genre of poetry film. And for those of us who don't know, can you tell us what is a poetry film?
Well, poetry film, according to the main poetry film festival in the world, the Zebra, which is in Berlin every 2 years, is a film that is an interpretation of a poem.
Right.
So it's not somebody filming someone else reading a poem. It's somebody looking at the narrative of the poem, looking at the story in the poem, and then creating a visual representation of that poem,
yes,
in visual form. And then it usually has either the words of the poem coming through or an audio of a poet reciting the words simultaneously to the visual.
Yeah. Yeah. And how did you come to make your film, which was shown at the Berlin Zebra Poetry Film Festival, and it was on Ian Duig's, the English poet's poem, The Llama's Hireling.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Well, I was involved in an MA in creative writing at WIT, and a colleague of mine, Sam Thomas, knew that I was looking for a poem to make a poetry film out of at the time, because we just come back from Berlin for the 2008, which you yourself were at, Poetry Film Festival, all inspired and ready to make poetry films.
Yes.
And then Sam just knocked and knocked until I listened and looked at this poem. And it's a phenomenal poem by Ian Duig, a very magical poem set in the late Victorian era, Northern Ireland, rural Northern Ireland.
Right, yes.
You know, which involves superstition and... it just took me, and I thought, I'll just start there, you know.
Yeah, and what ideas, how did you think of covering a poem? Because, I mean, it's a very difficult thing to do. And I'd imagine some poets not being... perhaps too into, you know, the film being, I mean, you know, poetry should stand on its own in many ways, you know, and but you know, so how did you approach, you know, because, and obviously you, I mean, I suppose you maybe not wanting to be too literal about it as well, how did you approach?
Yeah, well, it is a narrative poem, so right, that made it fairly simple from the outset.
Okay.
I think that wherever poetry can get press, you know, is worth pursuing, because not enough people read poetry. And if film is going to make it more accessible to people, then why not go that way? It does a huge, huge audience. I mean, the whole world at the moment it leans towards film rather than, look, music, obviously. But they've moved away from the written word to the visual image, you know, in such a great way that I think poetry should follow that as much as possible.
Absolutely. Well, it's made to, you know, the poetry. I mean, the television film is a medium of hearing, listening, as well as seeing. So there's no reason why poetry shouldn't work. Just as it seems to be made for the radio poetry.
It's ideal, and I also think that that engaging with a poem visually actually can shed more light onto the subject matter of the poem. Can actually give you more of an insight into what the writer is about, was on about.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, talking about, you know, making poetry accessible and things, I mean, there seems to be very much a renaissance, certainly in Cork and in Ireland, a real sort of, you know, resurgence of new voices, new poets coming up. Do you feel that? Does there seem to be sort of poetry coming to more people? Is it, or is that just something that, is this something that's always been happening? Do you feel?
Well, in ancient Irish history, certainly it was something that was every day. But over the last couple of hundred years, poetry in Ireland has suffered terribly, up until literally 20, 30 years ago, since the likes of Heaney and Mahon came up in the world. There wasn't much light on Irish poetry at all. And what's given that such a great boost, of course, is the explosion in technological advance, so that now poetry can fly from cell phone to iPad to email to Facebook to wherever, and it's you know, people are writing almost in poetry because they need to be so concise in their communications now as well. I think poetry is thriving in this new environment.
Yes, I mean, that's, one would imagine, you know, because poetry is much shorter than prose, you'd imagine in some ways with the fast-moving life where people can only read and perhaps on their bus journey, that the poem would be the perfect form, you know, for those things. But, yeah. You're currently on a reading tour and you're launching the book in several places. I think you've launched already in Cork, Limerick, and in Dublin last week. Where else are you launching the book?
And we also were down at Skibbereen in between, so we've got four down and about six to go on the island. So there's Galway,
right?
Still, I'm back in Dublin next week for the a world record breaking attempt. 111 writers are trying to read consecutively to break the world record.
Really? Wow. And then where is this, sorry?
It's in the Dublin Writers' Centre.
Okay.
This next weekend. We've got Letterkenny then on the 28th.
Very good, yeah.
And then we're back to Kinsale and then Bantry, all within the first week of July. And then we've got Bandon in September and Gothenburg. Right. And then we've got London in October. And then we're not sure whether we're getting Brighton and or Manchester on top of that, but that's as far as
That's a pretty extensive tour so far. Well, I wish you all the best of luck with that and with the book. It's a wonderful collection, and I'm sure it will do very well. Are you going to end? I think we're going to end with a short poem.
Yeah,
thanks very much, Paul. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks, Adam. It's great being here. Rain in the Glen, for Jim, my father, and after Christy Ring. At 12, Christy stood in goal, his first minor match for Cloyne. Those who held the keeper's hurl must have the gift of positioning. They must not lack courage, must be prepared to put up with the knocks and accept the abuses that go with it. I wait for you outside arrivals, and who looms through the static, about to belt one onto the runway, hurley tilted to a bronze wing, the heel swept away into legend, where everything is shining and breathing with the king who knew a patient wrist, the steady, vigilant burn, had you turn in the rain with no command, pelting close-range, waterlogged cannonballs, hair-split bones fracturing ash-white in this unyielding father of men who now walk tall as histories. Odd things happen thinking it. Did something of him enter me to face you in the calm goal of fatherhood, to lash you with endless silvered accolades per carpal fissure, the net holding still as the blue in your eyes on the ball, and this inky slitter pucks out letters from a stirred pen up and above Finbar's spire, the divisions of rivers and men.
Wonderful, Paul. Lovely. We've actually got a bit more time. Well, I mean, just take this opportunity to thank you again. But and to also say that our guest poet next week is the incomparable and wonderful Donegal poet Matthew Sweeney, who's lived out of Ireland as well in many different places. And perhaps we could just hear one last poem before. We've got the last track. I beg your pardon. Paul, perhaps you could just announce the last track.
Yeah, sure.
Of the evening.
Sure. This last track is by one of my favourite Irish bands, Keela. It's called The Mama Song.
Thanks very much.
Lost.
Irish supporters released from...